All right, 3 o'clock hour here on DGS. Dave is out, as we let you know earlier. He texted us this afternoon. We know a couple of days ago, Dave obviously left a bit early, got a call from the long-term care facility where his mom has been in hospice, saying he probably should come over, and he has been there, you know, I think most of the last couple of days. And it sounds like, you know, it's probably today or tomorrow she's going to pass. And, you know, all of us are obviously with Dave in spirit. We can't be there with him in person, but he's got family with him. And he let us know earlier that he wanted to make sure that we passed along to everybody listening, so they would just know. I mean, he views this show and everybody that listens to it as an extended family, and wants everybody to be aware of where things are. And that's where they are now. So again, we're all with Dave. We wish we could be with him in person, but obviously not really possible in this current scenario, but looking forward to seeing him when he's ready to come back. And when if there's anything that he wants us to pass along to you, we will absolutely do it. The rest of us are here. And of course, we're doing a lot today. We got Dave Murray with a quick hat. What do we call it? A live look.
Live look.
I was going to say a quick look. That's not what it is. A live look at the weather coming up after 3:30. We have Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe after the 4 o'clock news. So we'll be busy here for the next couple of hours of DGS. Happy to have Brad Young with us. Brad obviously is one of our legal analysts. He is a political analyst with us as well, and it's been a little while since we've talked, Brad, so a lot has changed since the last time you were on the show.
What? You know what? Slow news week. Completely slow news week. But I will tell you, I am a legal analyst, political analyst, but not a hair analyst. I mean, there's a limit to the stuff that I can analyze. But no, there's been a whole lot going on, and I'm glad to join you to catch up on a few things.
All right, so I guess let's go a little bit more in chronological order than in any, you know, like in terms, instead of going with what's most recent, let's just kind of walk back. These last couple of weeks, we had the assassination attempt against Donald Trump. That was shortly thereafter, followed by the news of, it was about 8 days later, Joe Biden stepping out of the race, Kamala Harris stepping into that spot. Just give us your overall view of the 2 weeks, whether or not you think this changes much as we're looking ahead to November, your thoughts on the choice of J.D. Vance as the vice presidential candidate, and obviously, you know, the decision made on the Democratic side for Joe to step down and Kamala Harris to step in.
Well, I'm impressed, Wheels, by the whiplash nature of what we've been hearing. I mean, for example, everyone thought that the Republican National Convention was going to be a yawn because there was never any real serious contender against Donald Trump.
Right.
And then we have the assassination attempt on Saturday. The convention starts on Monday. And now all of a sudden, the RNC convention takes on an entirely new dimension and emotional impact and excitement. Right. So then we're thinking, well, the Democrat convention is going to be a yawn because, again, no serious contender. Nobody's excited about Biden. And so it goes from the depths of boredom to now the heights of excitement, just like with the RNC, but obviously for different reasons. And so, yeah, politics at its core is an emotional response. It's an emotional response to a candidate, to hopes, to dreams, to vision. And so when these conventions harnessed those emotional responses, whether it's an attempt to kill one candidate or it's a step down and a transfer to literally the next generation of candidates, on both of those, I'm looking at these parties and saying they are really harnessing these events for their full emotional impact. And this is what's been missing in this campaign for a very long time.
So what do you think the outcome is here? Not necessarily, I'm not asking you for a prediction on who's going to be president. I'm just saying, with that energy, do you think this kind of thing leads to greater turnout, for example? Do we get a higher percentage participation because people are going to be a little bit more emotional about the attempt on Donald Trump's life? People are going to be a little more excited with a new candidate who's younger, all of that. Or do you think eventually by November we just kind of settle down?
Well, yeah. First of all, the American public has the attention span of a flea. So, yeah, there will be some calming down. But, you know, with both of these two candidates, because they both have high energy, I don't see this coming down to a great degree from where we are today. I mean, I see this as an emotionally charged election from here through November. And really, there's only two ways to get to increase votes. There's only two really ways. And that is, number one, to appeal to voters beyond your base, and number two, energize your base. And so what you're seeing here from both of these candidates is that they are both trying to energize their base. I don't know that there's a whole lot of an appeal right now to appealing to voters outside of the base, but both candidates are focusing on energizing their base. That was a strategy that worked extremely well for George Bush Jr., George Bush II. It worked well for him. But yet when you look at Bill Clinton or you look at Obama, both of those candidates expanded their base. They reached out and brought more people in to vote beyond their simple base. So those are contrasting views on how to get the vote out. But both of the current candidates, as far as I can tell, are focused on reaching their base. However, here's the big however. The question's the VP. I don't think that J.D. Vance is going to appeal to anyone outside of the Trump base. But depending on who Kamala Harris picks, whether it's a Mark Kelly or whether it's a Josh Shapiro or whether it's Andy Beshear out of Kentucky or even Roy Cooper out of North Carolina, any of those choices have the opportunity to do that Bill Clinton-esque, that Barack Obama-esque move of appealing to voters outside of your base, whereas neither Trump nor J.D. Vance can do that.
And probably a lot less, Brad, about the personality of whoever's chosen and more about whether or not they're popular in the particular states that are up for grabs. I mean, there aren't many.
Like
40, 43, 44 states. We have a pretty good idea where they're going to go. This will come down to 6 or 7.
Sure. Yeah, it absolutely will. And a lot of times the pick for a VP is not that big of a deal. It really wasn't. I mean, nobody really cared who Trump picked because it's all about Trump. But with Kamala Harris, if you look at the last few Democrats who have won the White House, they've won it based upon they were very likable people. Barack Obama, very likable. Bill Clinton, extremely likable. And you look at that, and then you look at the Democrats who weren't very likable. Hillary Clinton, not very likable. Michael Dukakis, not very likable. Kamala Harris, not very likable. Okay, so that's why I think in this race, who she picks as a VP on the likability standard is going to have a greater importance than most VPs because Kamala's detriment when it comes as a candidate is her likability. Look, when she ran for president before, nobody liked her. I mean, she had a great fanfare when she launched her campaign, and then she was out like almost immediately. So likability, believe it or not, it's important when you're running for student council president in high school, and it's still important when you're running for the presidency of the United States. That's one of Kamala's deficits here, and I think that's why they need to pick a VP candidate that's very likable.
All right, Brad, let's switch to the legal side. Take the political hat off, put the legal hat on.
Got it.
The legal story that I wanted to bring up to you is the one where the Trump campaign is challenging the transfer of campaign funds from Joe Biden to Kamala Harris. I know nothing about this law, so that's why I want to ask you, is there something there? Is there something potentially wrong here? Is this something to even talk about?
Well, first of all, we have to look at who decides the issue. All right. And this is decided by the Federal Elections Commission, which is a commission that has a Republican appointee, a Democrat appointee, and a chairman. So from that perspective, the question is, how does this fit in with FEC rules, Federal Election Commission rules? And the rules are rather vague when it comes to this, because frankly, it's never come up before.
Right.
And so the question becomes, as I dove into this a couple of days ago and started looking at this as a legal issue, the word keeps coming up as being the campaign is the word that's used in the FEC regulations. And so the question becomes, was that Joe Biden's money or was that the campaign's money, the Biden-Harris campaign's money? And if that's the way that it's viewed, then certainly I think you'll get a majority of that FEC commission. You'll get a majority there to say that it's still within the same campaign. So, for example, if all of a sudden Pete Buttigieg says, I'm running for president and now I got $91 million from Joe Biden, I think that would be an easy call. He wasn't part of the campaign.
Right. He wasn't on the ticket.
Wasn't on the ticket. Kamala Harris was on the ticket. So, number one, I think the preponderance of the evidence leads towards it being acceptable. But here's the bigger issue, Wheels, and that's this. The FEC is notoriously slow at investigating campaign violations. It sometimes takes them years to render decisions, which is ridiculous because the campaign's over, the money's already gone, and then they come and say, oh, hey, you shouldn't have done that, right? It happens all the time. Candidates get fined all the time, and usually it's a year after the election. So nothing, I promise you, zero will be decided between now and November, but sometime in 2025 or 2026, they're going to come out and reach a decision, which by then, of course, is patently unnecessary and moot.
Is there anything beyond a fine that there's power to hear? Like, are there any laws that can be violated here that are more than just FEC decided regulations?
Well, there would have to be some sort of a procedure, and I don't know how this would happen. I mean, you'd have to really talk to an attorney that does nothing but campaign law, but one would have to go get an injunction under federal law to prevent the transfer and use of the money, and then schedule that for a temporary restraining order to prevent or block Harris from using that money and utilizing those funds. I don't see any activity from the Trump campaign doing that. So since there's no attempt to try to get some sort of a temporary restraining order, my feeling is that was a political filing more than we think we're going to win this on a legal issue type filing. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So then they can crow and say, look, we filed a complaint and this is outrageous. This is theft. This is terrible. But at the end of the day, if you're not asking for an injunction, then there's no teeth to that complaint.
All right. One last thing, Brad. And I will see, you know, this is it's an interesting story because it's obviously happening here. We just had this ruling from the Missouri Supreme Court that blocked the release of Christopher Dunn. Just curious if you have any thoughts or if you've had any chance to look into that.
I have. And here's what I think is getting people riled up about this. If you have a criminal trial, and again, let's talk in hypotheticals before talk about Mr. Dunn. Hypothetically, John Smith is on trial for murder. The jury finds him to be not guilty. And then he just walks out of the courthouse. He's done. He's a free man, right?
Yep.
So people are thinking about that when they look at this situation and saying a judge has overturned his conviction. Why can't he just walk out the door? But those are two completely different situations. Once you have been adjudicated by a jury as being not guilty, you're free to go. The state has no further legal right to keep you behind bars. But that's not exactly the way it works in situations where a judge later makes a legal determination, not a factual determination, but a legal determination that guilty verdict should be overturned, and that is allowed to have an appeal. I'm not saying it's right to keep him in prison. I mean, maybe they could have let him go and then revisit this issue later, but that's where I think the confusion is coming by folks comparing it to the guy who's on trial and is adjudicated, as opposed to this, which is a legal ruling some three decades after he was found guilty.
So you don't have, I mean, I guess, you know, this is the equivalent of the decisions over bail and whether or not someone would be released pending trial versus being incarcerated while their trial is pending, or is it more complex than that?
Well, I think that's a fair comparison, Kevin, because in this situation, the judge has made a legal decision that the evidence that found him guilty today is not viable evidence. But that's subject to review on appeal. Contrary to a situation where someone is literally on trial and the jury acquits that person, at that point, he can never be recharged with that crime. He's free to go. So yes, it's kind of like a bail situation. And so we can have a discussion about whether Mr. Dunn should be released pending this appeal or not. But I don't think that just the issue of the Supreme Court of Missouri saying we're still going to rule on this, I don't see that as being improper.
Brad, thanks so much.
My pleasure, guys.
And we'll get a live look at today's weather, but also the next couple of days with Dave Murray here in just a couple of minutes. We'll do that right after the news. Let's do some fun facts. Got a little time here.
Yeah, we've got some fun facts for you, starting with some American history fun facts. Only four people in American history have won a presidential election as a sitting vice president: John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Martin Van Buren, and George H.W. Bush.
Yeah. I know I was alive for one of those.
Yeah, I was not.
You guys.
Bubblegum is pink because that's the only color of food coloring that the inventor had available at the time. Just funny how those things happen.
I love stuff like that.
It was the perfect fit, I guess.
Yeah.
What
I
if
love
it had
stuff
been
like that, where it's like,
what if it had been black?
Yeah. And
yeah,
then it
like
makes
green
your teeth
or
black.
Something.
Licorice.
Yeah.
The inventor of the children's ball pit got the idea when he was looking at pickled onions floating in a jar and thought about what it would be like to try to crawl through them. Now, I haven't been in a ball pit in about, you know, a long time, decades and decades, but I remember exactly what it, like, every time you jump in, you're just like, all right, I'm in the zone. I'm in the ball pit now.
Yeah. It's such a rare, because it was a rare treat, right?
Say, yes.
It was something you always wanted, but rarely happened.
I think as a kid, I only did it one time, and I got in there, and I'm like, okay, now what?
Then you
just get back out and jump in again, right?
Yeah.
Of course.
And it cushions
your
fall.
No, I'm serious. I was like,
yo, I know you're serious.
I didn't know what to do. Like,
this
is boring. I swim? No, I didn't say that. I was like, do I swim? Do I jump around? Do I go underneath? I didn't know.
You go underneath and wait for the next kid to jump on.
Yeah, land on my face.
You sit in traffic now, but later, there's an ice cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, all your patience is paid out in gold. You remain calm through honks, bumper to bumper, and people yelling.
Come on, move!
You are a fighter. Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
3:35 on DGS. Rachel here. Andrew. Kevin. I did it. I did the third person, but I called my name. I used my first name. Does that make it better?
I think it does make it a little better.
It does.
Better.
It sounds a little less weird when you refer to when you refer to yourself by your nickname. That's definitely weirder than just even your own name. And we do not have Dave Murray, but we do have a live look at the weather, so we all know what's coming up in the next couple of days.
Could not be with you live today, but wanted to give you an update on our weather and take you through the last weekend of July and into the last couple of days of July and into the month of August. Could still see a spot thunderstorm, little pop-up storm this evening, and then they all fade with the setting sun. Friday's a quiet day. We've had a little cool front come through, so a little more of a north to northeast flow. Mostly sunny skies Friday. How about 86 degrees? We can handle that. Quiet times Friday night. On to the weekend. Saturday, partly sunny skies. Maybe a spot thunderstorm, but a lot of rain-free time on Saturday and a delightful 86 degrees. Quiet times Saturday night. On Sunday, partly sunny skies. The big deal on Sunday is we're going to start to see a rise in the humidity, especially during the afternoon. Now, it's nothing extreme, but we're going to start to see that uptick, and that uptick brings some scattered thunderstorms, no all-day rain. We'll just kind of watch the sky on Sunday. 88 degrees, but it's all about summer all of next week. It's hot, it's humid. Southerly flow from the Gulf of Mexico is wide open. Talking like low 90s Monday and Tuesday, mid 90s on Wednesday and Thursday, and could be in the upper 90s by the end of the week. We'll watch for these pop-up thunderstorms all of next week in the heat and humidity, but the big deal is the return of summer. There you have it. Talk to you live tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, Dave. We appreciate it. Let us turn our attention to headlines.
Headlines is brought to you by Schnucks. Reward yourself daily with the Schnucks Rewards app. All right. Shoplifting has skyrocketed by 24% across the United States, even as most other crimes fell to pre-pandemic levels. Rates of shoplifting rose an average 24% during the first half of 2024 compared to that same period last year, according to the Council on Criminal Justice's mid-year crime report released today.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
I mean, not totally shocking, right? Because we've given, I mean, in the last year or so, we've seen the stories of certain stores closing in some areas because they were having trouble with smash and grabs or, you know, groups of people running in and grabbing things and running out. Although that's little bit different than your traditional version of shoplifting, but wonder if there's an explanation, if it's just a
it's ever since the pandemic.
Okay.
The shoplifting has steadily been on the rise since we began emerging from the pandemic around 2022, and now it stands at about 10% higher than pre-pandemic levels.
I'm just curious if it's economy driven or like it just became okay in people's minds right after the pandemic. I'm like, you know, like people's attitudes shifted a little bit about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Either way, not great.
Sources say Obama is behind Vice President Kamala Harris, even though he has not formally endorsed her yet. But I also saw another source reporting on CNN that he is expected to endorse her very soon.
I'd be shocked if he didn't.
Did anyone watch Joe Biden's address to the nation last night?
He's still president? No.
He is. I watched. He was extremely tan. I don't know if they gave him some self-tanner. Yeah, it's like to brighten him up or something, but he was very tan, and he appeared to be wearing white eyeliner on his bottom lashes. Or his bottom, like, waterline.
I don't know what that is. What's your waterline?
Like, right here.
Okay.
So they got him all spiffy looking. He did say, I thought it was a great address. He basically said, you know, I do have personal ambitions, but I care about my country more. And he says it's time for younger voices and time to pass the torch to a new generation, explaining that his personal ambition cannot get in the way of saving our democracy.
I had something on the rundown today just related to what he was talking about there about it's time for younger generations to take control. It's about time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why didn't we realize this in his case? Why wasn't this the plan all along? Because we heard the reports from 2020 that said he's only going to run for one term and then step aside and let somebody else take the reins. And then it changed, and now you get the last minute change. This needs to be more of a broad attitude, in my opinion. I know you guys probably get sick of hearing it, but at some point, that generation needs to move aside to let the next generations to start taking care of business, because the future we will all be living in is going to be lived in by those that are younger. it's not a knock, right? I mean, like, you know, the people that have devoted their lives to this deserve thanks for doing the stuff that they've done, but we do need to have a realization sooner that it's time to move on. You know, and again, this is one of those, I feel like I say this all the time because I do, but like, this is another thing in the world of sports. We're just, you know what? Things are just clearer in sports. When a guy gets old, everybody says, bro, you're old, retire.
Yeah.
You know, like when you start to slip, people like, okay, dude, see ya. And when you're doing the job well, people like, keep on doing that job. And there's a winner and there's a loser. And there's nobody saying, I want to change the rules or the rules are bad. You just have the game and it's played. I know it's the oversimplification because it is a game and not actual important stuff. But I do wish we had more of those types of attitudes and the recognition that, all right, you know what? It is time for me to move out of the way for someone who's going to be better than me.
Melania Trump is releasing a memoir this fall. It's called Melania, and it's being billed by her office as a powerful and inspiring story of a woman who has carved her own path, overcome adversity, and defined personal excellence. There's no specific release date yet, but you can look forward to the fall for Melania's memoir.
Think she drops any bombs?
Highly doubtful.
Yeah,
she doesn't seem like a bomb dropper.
No. I wouldn't want that. It's what everybody does, right? When you write a book, you save all the nasty stuff for your book.
The NBA has announced a massive rights deal involving Disney, Comcast, and Amazon. The deal is for 11 years, which will net the NBA over $76 billion.
Mm-hmm.
It also marks the first time since the 1980s that the NBA will not be broadcasting games on the TNT network.
Right. This is a big change for sports fans because TNT has done an amazing job. You know, their studio show with Charles Barkley, Shaquille O'Neal, Ernie Johnson. Those guys are, it's been arguably, and Mike Claiborne has said this many times, and I think I agree with Claibs, this might be the best show on television.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny. They do talk about things other than the NBA, but most of all, it's just flat out entertainment, and it's a big change for basketball fans that are coming in there. I had this down on the list the other day, but I took it off. But I'm curious if you guys have a reaction, because you just mentioned the total deal. It's basically $10.5 billion a year. And it's not quite $11 billion, but it's right there around $10 billion a year for the NBA. And there's the story that went along with this is the WNBA is also included in these TV deals. Now it's separate, but like the negotiations were happening together. And the WNBA's rights will be $200 million a year as opposed to $10 billion. And by the way, that is also like seven times their old TV deal.
Okay.
So it's growing quite a bit, but there was a little bit of noise from the WNBA's Players Association. Like, why is it? We feel like we're being undervalued. And I think it's a weird way to look at it to me, because number one, it grows so much, but it's all based on ratings. It's all based on how many people are watching,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, the TV networks are paying the NBA because they know that these tens of millions of people are watching it all the time over the course of the year. And while the WNBA is growing, and again, that's I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that's going to impact those players quite a bit. Like, a lot of what's available for player salaries in sports comes from guaranteed TV deals. So the WNBA players are going to be making a lot more money moving forward than they would be under the old deal. So it's good for them. I'm glad it's growing. I'm really curious to see how much this carries, right? There's been a lot of buzz this year, and I don't remember the numbers, but Caitlin Clark's games have been drawing great numbers. And I'm curious to see how much of that lasts. And because it would be really cool if it did. It'd be really cool if you're just like, people are exposed to it and like, ah, you know what? I really like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it continues to grow. I'm going to be really fascinated to see kind of what the next 5 years look like.
The Argentina soccer team was robbed at the 2024 Olympics. This is terrible. Their Paris quarters were reportedly looted while they were practicing on Tuesday. They're missing watches, rings, everything for training at the Olympics. They didn't want to say anything until after the training. This is what they're, according to their coach. And it's unclear if Paris police have been notified of the crime, but that's awful. You go to play in the Olympics and then someone comes and steals all your stuff.
That is absolutely brutal. I got an Olympic story that I want to throw into headlines, because okay. I just saw this a little bit ago and I wrote it down and I wanted to get you guys in on it. So an Australian field hockey player had to make, I think most of us would agree that it's a pretty difficult decision, but he had to make a really difficult decision to be able to compete in the Olympics. And field hockey is obviously a very physical sport. There's a lot of contact. It's a lot like lacrosse in that way. What if I told you guys that you had to cut off a finger to participate in the Olympics? Would you cut your finger off?
No.
Depends on how badly I wanted to be in the Olympics.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's your dream. It's literally what it's basically the peak of what you can do in your sport.
Yeah.
And you've been working for it your entire life.
I probably do.
Now, to give you the background on it a little bit, he's an Australian player who suffered an injury that was really bad. And basically they said the only way we can save the finger is if you don't go to the Olympics. But if you want to play in the Olympics, we just have to amputate and get rid of the finger, and then you can continue. And he chose to do it. And I got to say, I would be on team amputate my finger.
Yeah, I think I would, too.
I wouldn't even think twice about it in that scenario.
Yeah.
For a regular thing, probably not.
Which finger?
Well, I don't know. Remember, I can't remember which finger it is for him. But honestly, probably any of them. But certainly more
of the back two.
Like,
yeah,
certainly more of the pinky could go.
You could have those now. I mean, you can just take them.
He's like, I got no
use
for this.
Just out of nowhere. Here, you can take my pinky, please.
Yeah, please.
But, you know, this happened in the NFL. It happened to Ronnie Lott. He got his finger all crooked and bent. And instead of fixing it, they just went, see ya.
Let's do one more story before we take a break. Biden's withdrawal from the 2024 election resulted in 38,500 people registering to vote in the 48 hours after he dropped out of the race. Of the new voters, 83% were between the ages of 18 and 34 years old.
Were they registering because they were interested in Harris, or?
Yeah, it was after he dropped out of the race and endorsed Kamala. So the implication there is that they were so excited about her that they went out and registered to vote for the first time.
All right.
By the way, it's 3:47, brought to you by FIRA Capital Management.
Coming up on 4 o'clock here on DGS, we'll have Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe coming up after the 4 o'clock news. In the meantime, let's talk about some travel news, Rach. I know this has been generating attention. In fact, we've had a couple of packages on it during the top of the hour news here on Camo X. But Southwest Airlines is going ahead with the changes they've been talking about.
Yeah, they're ending open seating and introducing red-eye flights. But getting rid of open seating seems to be a pretty popular decision from them. They conducted some research and found that 80% of current customers and 86% of potential customers expressed a preference for assigned seating, which, you know, in the past, of course, you would just get ready and check in early and try to get your seat when you showed up for the Southwest flight. And now they're going in the same direction as every other major airline.
I like it.
I like it, too. I never like the uncertainty of those Southwest flights.
You have to set your alarm like 24 hours in advance and try to get in group A or B.
Or you pay, you know, another $30 for early bird.
Yeah.
Check in, and it's like, well, at that point, is it really like such a democratic process?
No,
if you can pay,
I like the idea of being able to do it. So when if you're the first to buy the tickets, you get the first choice of where you're going to get to sit. Just like going to a ball game, just like going to the movie. By the way, this is my favorite change in the movies.
It is nice to have assigned seats.
I'm so happy that it's not just open seating that you get to pick your seats. That's way easier.